The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to The Business of Giving. I'm your host, Denver Frederick, and thank you for taking the time to join me tonight. We're going to start with an issue that people are increasingly becoming more concerned about. That is the mental, social, and spiritual health of the nation. We'll discuss that and what needs to be done with Tyler Norris, the CEO of Wellbeing Trust.
Life expectancy in the United States is decreasing, and issues such as opioid overdose, alcohol-related deaths, and suicides are becoming a leading cause of disability in the United States. It's the equivalent of about 9 school buses going over the cliff every single day.
And we'll double up with 2 reports from our partners at the Chronicle Philanthropy and have a better-than-most corporate culture segment for you as we visit the offices of Truth Initiative. But first, the Business of Giving News Digest for this Father's Day. Impact investing finds itself at a tipping point, with nearly 3/4 of affluent millennial and Gen X donors engaged in some form of it, a report from Fidelity Charitable finds. According to a new survey conducted by the BDO Institute for Nonprofit Excellence, larger organizations tend to face greater liquidity challenges and are more likely to maintain a lower level of reserves as compared to moderate-sized organizations. Sexual harassment is derailing the careers of far too many women in science, engineering, and medicine. That's the central message of a searing new report from the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine on the prevalence of sexual misconduct in those fields. Foundations in the United States should step up their support for innovative and effective social change networks in the South, which offers fertile soil for developing solutions to national problems. Between 2011 and 2015, U.S. foundations invested only 56 cents per capita in southern states for every dollar per capita invested nationally. Colleges facing the new endowment tax are getting some relief. They won't be taxed on unrealized income from their billions of dollars in assets before the levy was approved. And a growing number of e-cigarette and vaporizer sellers have started offering college scholarships as a way to get their brands listed on university websites and to get students to write essays about the potential benefits of vaping. And finally, with Giving USA reporting record charitable fundraising 3 years in a row, and with an economy that's been humming along quite nicely, one might suspect that the number of donors to charity is on the rise. But quite the opposite is the case, which is a cause for concern for many experts in the sector. The disappearing donor is the cover story of the June Chronicle of Philanthropy, as reported by Nicole Wallace, who is with us now. Good evening, Nicole.
Good evening.
So how significant is the drop of Americans who donate to charity?
You know, the drop is pretty eye-popping. In the last, between 2000 and 2014, the share of Americans that give to charity drops by 10%.
Mm.
And it's not any one group where the drop happened. The decreases were across all different age groups, different income levels, levels of education, single people, married people. Across the board, the numbers who are giving are dropping, which was really a surprise, I think, to a lot of people.
Absolutely. What are some of the reasons given for this decline?
I guess the first thing to say is that no one knows for sure why this decline is happening. People have a lot of theories. The first factor that comes to mind is the Great Recession, and that I think that definitely has to have had an effect. There are a lot of people whose disposable income has only recently returned to those pre-recession levels. But the drop in the number of people who give is across all income levels. And so folks think that there are probably other reasons at work. Some people have speculated the fact that there are so many, there are a lot of ways to give and contribute to causes now beyond making charitable gifts. I talked to a nonprofit official who said, you know, think about it. If you care about the environment, yes, you can make a donation to an environmental group, but you could also, you know, invest in a company that's creating clean energy. You could get a fuel-efficient car. Mm. You could, you know, you could put solar panels on your house. You know, there are a lot more ways for people to express their values beyond just making the charitable donations. There's been some thought that the decrease in religious participation could actually be playing a role in this. There's been research that's indicated that someone who identifies with their religion or attends worship services is more likely to give both to religious causes mm-hmm. and to secular causes. And as religious affiliation is dropping in the United States, that there might be a connection to the drop in donors. So there are a lot of factors that could be at play.
Absolutely. Well, with organizations continuing to raise more money year over year, why are experts so concerned about this trend?
You know, I think people are concerned not so much about today, but they're thinking further ahead. Right now, big gifts are masking some of this drop. There are nonprofits that are receiving donations from fewer donors, but they're actually raising more money because those gifts that they are getting are larger. Generally speaking, someone doesn't make $1 million gift the first time out. There have been some colleges that have taken a look at their records, and I think Brown University looked at it a few years ago, and when someone makes their first $1 million gift, it tends to be the seventh, eighth, ninth gift that they've made to the institution. So if people aren't making small gifts now, they aren't necessarily going to be in the pipeline, 10 years down the road when they might be in a position to make a six or seven figure gift.
That makes an awful lot of sense. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so people are concerned about the future, but at the same time, fundraisers have so much pressure to bring in money today for today's needs, today's programs. It's really hard, I think, to step back and really think about, well, gosh, what's going to happen to my organization 10 years from now, 20 years from now, when there's so much pressure today.
Right, and they probably won't even be there then, so they're looking at it from a short-term perspective. Finally, Nicole, what are some of the things that organizations are doing to combat this decline of donors?
Sure. So one of the most basic things that the experts tell us that nonprofits can do is really, really think about retention. It's a lot easier to encourage a current supporter to make an additional gift than to go out and find a brand new supporter. So nonprofits are looking at their retention rates, and one way a lot of groups have found to increase their retention rates is to focus more on monthly giving, asking people to make a commitment to give each month or each quarter. There are other groups that they look at this problem and they say, you know what, I need to double down, and I need to find more donors who look like my current donors. So groups like the Nature Conservancy are focusing on online donor acquisition, and they're trying to get much more sophisticated about it, trying to build online acquisition to scale to the same scale that direct mail acquisition has been for a long time.
Yeah.
And then other groups are trying to expand the universe of people that support them. One really interesting example is the Sierra Club is in the early stages of trying to figure out how they can reach out to Latino populations and sort of expand the universe of people who are interested in their work.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have some wonderful examples in the article, including PBS, which is going door to door and knocking on people's doors and soliciting in that fashion. Well, this is a very significant development, and I want to thank you, Nicole, for being here and giving us this report.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
I'll be back to speak with Abby Maxman of Oxfam America right after this.
The Business of Giving is pleased to feature news correspondents every week from the Chronicle of Philanthropy, a trusted source of daily news on the nonprofit world. A subscription to the Chronicle gets you instant access to practical online tools like checklists, resource guides, and expert advice, and in-depth insight into the big ideas and trends that are transforming the nonprofit world. Learn more at philanthropy.com. That's the Chronicle of Philanthropy at philanthropy.com. Welcome back to the Business of Giving with Denver Frederick.
American lives are shorter, on average, than those in other wealthy nations, and the gap is growing ever wider, according to the latest data released by the Center for Disease Control. In fact, it appears that in 2017, U.S. life expectancy will drop for a third year in a row, an event that hasn't occurred in over 100 years. As Americans, we are not faring well. But there's a young organization that is dedicated to advancing the mental, social, and spiritual health of the nation. It's called Wellbeing Trust, and it's a pleasure to have with us their Chief Executive Officer, Tyler Norris. Good evening, Tyler, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Trevor, thanks for having me on. Glad to be here.
Give us a snapshot of Wellbeing Trust and tell us how the organization came to be.
The Wellbeing Trust is a new national foundation with a mission to advance the mental, social, and spiritual health of the country. When two large Catholic health systems, Providence St. Joseph Health, came together 2 years ago, the executives and sponsors of the organization were looking at the horizon of what is driving poor health outcomes in the country and recognized that unaddressed mental health and substance use issues were not only a leading cause of disability in the United States, but that they were fundamentally undercutting our ability to address other chronic diseases. And so this large health system, the third largest hospital system in the country, made a commitment to really not only transform the way we address mental health and substance use issues, but also to focus on prevention and to go upstream on what creates good health in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Well, the dimensions of this crisis are truly staggering, and you have documented the scope in a report you helped to produce called Pain in the Nation. What does that picture look like today, Tyler, and what are the projections for the coming decade?
Well, I think the most important thing, and you said it in your opening, is that life expectancy in the United States is decreasing, and issues such as opioid overdose, alcohol-related deaths, and suicides are becoming a leading cause of disability in the United States. It's the equivalent of about 9 school buses going over the cliff every single day. And it's hard for, I think, us as a nation to get our heads around the scale of the tragedy. We understand, we hear about the opioid crisis, and we kind of wonder what's really driving it. Of course, recently some higher profile suicides are pointing, shedding the light on the pervasive rates of suicides, whether it's our young people or our veterans or aging adults. And I think it's essentially a clarion call to, one, we need to understand what's killing us. Secondly, that there are things that are working. And in fact, there's quite an evidence base around what works to address these issues. And then build the community and political will to be able to address these issues in a meaningful way. So that's what Pain in the Nation was for us, a chance to build awareness, recognize what works, and call for a national resilience strategy.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know this is a complicated and multifaceted issue, but what do you think? Why do you think this is happening now?
Well, I think it's a really important question, and one that I'll try and put some answers towards, but I think needs to be part of the national debate.
Mm-hmm.
These so-called deaths of despair, alcohol, drug-related, and suicide, disabilities and fatalities, tie to a great extent to loneliness, to hopelessness, to a sense of disconnection, are often related to social isolation. So even in a period when we with social media and other ways that we appear to be connected, many of us are feeling less connected to each other than ever. In fact, it's said that 40% of us don't have a best friend or a confidant that we feel comfortable going to. It's also, the data would suggest that loneliness, person experiencing persistent and ongoing loneliness, is the equivalent of smoking about 15 cigarettes a day. So loneliness, disconnection, despair, hopelessness are really upstream from the ways that we are then self-medicating with alcohol, opioids and other substances, or choosing to take our lives and die by suicide. That's what we think is actually underneath it, a much greater trauma-related and social-cultural issue, not just the prevalence of these substances.
Yeah, and that seems to be particularly true for men, because I know so many guys who don't have a best friend. It just seems to be an epidemic almost.
Well, it really is. It's interesting. I mean, I know we'll spend time talking about the rates of these deaths for communities of color and young people. But it's fascinating looking at what's happening to those that we would expect would be doing pretty well, particularly white middle-class men who we would think with all the privilege would be doing well. And the rates in that population are as high as ever. And I think it's connected to what's my opportunity? Am I doing okay? Am I connected to my family? Are my kids going to do better than me?
Yeah.
And in many cases, we're seeing that many kids born today will not do better than their parents. And I think that's it's very difficult on the current across all generations now.
Well, there's so many things to talk about. Let's start with mental health. And there are some 44 million Americans who experience a mental health issue. How do you believe the national conversation surrounding mental health has to change in the coming years to better address this crisis? And what role will the Well-Being Trust be pursuing to help guide and frame that conversation?
Well, first of all, I think that the most important point is that these mental health issues, anxiety, depression, thoughts of suicide, and other related issues, substance use issues, that these issues are all of us. This isn't just some people in some pockets. These are our brothers and sisters and parents, our kids, our school teachers, our coworkers. It's all of us. So we might say 1 in 4 or 1 in 5 of us are struggling with these issues. But the truth is, it's all of us.
Yeah.
Because we are all bound up with each other in our families and at work and at school. So I think the first thing to recognize is that this is an issue that affects every single one of us, where we live, work, play, shop, worship, etc. Secondly, we have to be able to talk about mental health issues and address our anxiety and depression and thoughts of suicide no different than we would our diabetes or our hypertension or a knee injury. There's no reason to be ashamed for experiencing these issues. These are chronic diseases that many of us have, and the first thing we need to be able to have is a conversation about it without the kind of stigma that shuts it down. I think many of us are afraid to talk about those issues, and that's got to be the beginning, is to tell the truth about what we're struggling with and what our families are struggling with so that we can begin to show up for each other. So one is just being able to have a safe conversation, and that's what we are really noticing happening right now from our youth, from many influencers and celebrities whose stories are finally coming out and maybe making it safer for most of us to address it. So that's really the beginning for us, is to change and open the conversation. And then we can start to say what needs to happen in our clinical settings and in schools and in the workplace and in our communities. And there's an evidence base that we might talk about. But we have to be able to open the conversation first.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know one of the things you're trying to do in removing that stigma is conduct a campaign that is targeted towards youth. Tell us about a few of those efforts.
Well, we decided early on that we were going to focus on tweens and teens.
Mm-hmm.
Tweens, kind of ages 9 to 12, and teens, obviously 13, and onto young adulthood, maybe up to 25, as a primary focal point for us. One is that, as all of us know, as we approach teenagerhood, there's more agency, more freedom. A lot of kids have a cell phone. They begin to have exposure to substances, opportunities around sexuality, et cetera. And so the sort of agency and freedom is places our teenagers at ever younger ages around choices about how will they address the social and cultural pressures they may face at school, and what are they going to do when they start feeling hurt or bullied or are traumatized by something that happens, and do they begin to develop patterns of reaching for alcohol, reaching for cannabis, reaching for other substances, cutting, bullying, you know, what is it that young people start to do with these challenges? And so because those patterns are put in place early, and over half of mental health issues later in life become active around age 14 or 15, we know we need to focus on teens. So in partnership with iHeartMedia, BuzzFeed, Complex, mm-hmm. Oxy, and other media partners, we've been beginning a conversation about let's make it normal to talk about these kinds of issues. And we've even been training DJs to be able to speak during drive time to parents and kids to be able to open the conversation in the car on the way to school. But that's not where it stops. We want to make sure that every child and their parents, for that matter, knows where to get help, how to give help, and essentially show up for each other, be good listeners, help our friends get help when they need it, and in fact, make sure that they reach out for professional help. And third, that they know how to activate. That, you know, what can I do at my school or work or place of worship? So getting help, giving help, and activating is where we're going once we build a awareness around these issues. And young people are rising to the occasion all across the country.
Let me ask you a little bit more about that, and particularly as it relates to getting help, because I'll tell you that what I've observed, whether it be in mental health or even addiction, people generally don't know what to do. They don't know where to go or how to go about it. What advice would you give them?
Well, first of all, organizations like Crisis Text Line and the hotlines that exist nationally in communities across the country are available as a one-stop shop to be able to get help in a time of crisis. And so one of the most important things that someone can do who's struggling, or if you're aware of somebody struggling, is pick up the phone or pick up a text and dial Crisis Text Line or reach out and begin a conversation with a peer supporter on the other line, on the other end of the line. Mm-hmm. That, for many people, is the beginning. I think for about 90% of us, and we'll come back to the acute, you know, real issues in a minute, for 90% of us, we just need someone to talk with, you know, and to open a conversation and be able to talk about our struggles, et cetera. So for many who are not sort of at the edge of doing something, being able to reach to a friend and creating a safe container as a place to begin, or being that for someone, is really important. But otherwise, we need to be able to talk to our primary care physician or a coach or a teacher, depending on age or where we find ourselves, and ask about where to get help in our community, because there are many organizations in every community across the country, which is not to say there's not a shortage of providers. There is a shortage of psychiatrists and mental health providers. But there's much that we can do with peers, much that we can be supported by community-based organizations, and then these crisis text lines and others are a place to go when the issues get rough.
You know how important it is, Tyler, for people to have purpose and meaning in their life, a sense of belonging, of contributing. These are so central to a person's sense of self and to their overall health. What can be done to help provide opportunities for people to connect with these things when they're absent from someone's life?
Well, first of all, you're really putting your finger on some of the underlying drivers of the mental health crisis and suicide and substance issues that we're talking about here. In partnership with the Greater Good Science Center and 19th U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy, we've been working to identify what really are the underlying drivers of well-being. Or when we talk about resilience, which is sort of the protective factors, what's there? The first of these is purpose, that someone's saying, this is why I'm here. This is what I have to bring. This is my contribution or my gift, particularly for young people, to know what it is they have to contribute and that gives them meaning in life is vital. Secondly, to have a sense of belonging, like who can I trust? Where do I belong? Where do I feel safe? Those two are vital predictors of well-being or predictors of resilience. But also the third is around awe and wonder, the ability to experience a sense of awe and wonder at beauty or a conversation or a great meal or a walk in the park in nature, to be able to experience ourselves as part of something greater than just our own mental conversation with ourselves. And fourth, the opportunity to give back and to be able to be generous. That virtuous cycle drives the well-being and are the predictors of resilience. So what we're looking at in schools and in the workplace is helping young people connect with their sense of purpose or meaning or what brings them joy. to be able to create safe places to go, to have experiences that give us a sense of connection and how we're bound up with people around us, and meaningful opportunities to give back. And initiatives in schools and in workplaces and communities around the country are actually taking up that mantle as a way to address the underlying drivers of our mental health crisis before they become acute and express themselves as significant, serious depression or a fundamental substance use issue.
Absolutely. Well, let's move on to communities. And I think much of the disease in this country is really just not simply from a lack of access to health care. It's also shaped by where someone lives. And it's been, I don't know, maybe 30 years since the birth of Healthy Cities, Healthy Communities movement in the United States. What kind of grade would you give it after these three decades?
Well, my daughter is 23, and she came home a couple of years ago with a report from the Institute of Medicine that basically said after the previous century, 20th century, where lifespan expanded over 25 years, in the current decade, many children born today are likely to live 5 years less than their parents. Mm. And my daughter, wisely, was saying, Dad, you've been working on these health issues with all your colleagues for three decades, and we're going backwards. You know, what is the matter with us as a country?
Nice job, Dad.
Her joke was, what have you been doing? Yeah. And I think that's a great question for this country. What have we been doing that we spend 18% of our national product on sick care services, and yet our health is declining? A couple of reasons. One is that our health system, and this is a, and this is not a partisan comment, this is just true.
Yeah.
Our health system is primarily rewarded for the volume of care that is provided. And so until, and we can maybe get to this a little later, we actually start rewarding what creates health in the first place and create an incentive around that. Our sick care system, we have to recognize, is only 10% of what creates health, and it is just not incentivized to create health. It's incentivized to provide treatment, which is fine, and we all appreciate the care when we need it. But if it's only 10% of what creates health, and we know that 60% of what creates health has to do with our lifestyle and our behavior and the socioeconomics in which we live, then that's where the locus of change is. And it has to do with income and education and access to safe, affordable housing, access to transportation and mobility to be able to get to work or school or to other resources in our communities. It's essentially these community conditions that give rise to health, not only access to care. So it is vital that everybody has access to a physician and a medical home. That is critical. But if we're trying to improve the health of the country, we need to make sure we're investing in these community determinants, not only access to sick care. And that means that it's a civic issue where mayors and business leaders and nonprofit leaders and public health and hospital leaders and faith leaders, et cetera, need to come together to address these underlying issues.
Well, let me pick up on both those things. First, let's start with the changing of the mindset, and also, I think, Tyler, the changing of the business model. Because you're saying, if I hear you right, that we have to have a marketplace that's going to value health outcomes and not the amount of health care services that are provided. How do you see such a transition occurring?
Well, it's very challenging because the typical model where we have our insurance or we have Medicare or Medicaid and they basically pay the provider is essentially a volume-based system that is not inherently wrong. It just doesn't incentivize health. It incentivizes treatment. So what we have seen is increasing at-risk arrangements like we see many states taking on with Medicaid, or we see integrated health systems. Many of the nonprofit health systems that are delivery systems are increasingly offering health plans. There are some large integrated systems like Kaiser Permanente that are an integrated provider and health system. And those kinds of systems that are incentivized to provide high quality care at the best cost while investing in what produces health in the first place is the future of health in the United States. That is a market that values health, not just a market that values health care. We've seen, I'll just pick on one, I think, very exciting example in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and the Twin Cities. Over the last few years, with waivers that came from the White House and Congress around Medicaid, in the state of Minnesota, Hennepin County took a fixed Medicaid payment from the state for 20,000 of its most high utilizing patients. And when they got that big check for the 20,000 individuals or covered lives, mm-hmm. that was all that the county's going to get. Mm. So then they started saying, what shall we invest in? And because many of these people were housing insecure and food insecure, were not taking their meds, that the leaders in Hennepin County said, we're at risk now for health. We've got this one check, and we've got to care for these 20,000 people. They invested in safe, affordable housing. They invested in making sure that people were getting access to healthy, fresh food that might help them address their diabetes or hypertension. And they made sure they were getting case management to be able to take meds and make sure they were working a health plan. So when you go at risk for health, it fundamentally changes the incentives, and you begin to invest in the community determinants like they did in Hennepin County, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and as we see examples in Vermont and in California and in Texas, in red states, in blue states, in conservative communities, in progressive communities. And we're beginning to see a transpartisan understanding, particularly at the community level, that when you create at-risk arrangements, you begin to invest in what creates health in the first place, not only sick care services.
And what was the threat in all these communities? Because, you know, there's always such a challenge of breaking down these silos. Because as you talk about these issues, affordable housing and mobility and education and access to healthy food, and sometimes even the leaders in the healthcare sector are somewhat protective, how do you get these communities to work together? What's been the secret sauce to that?
Well, first of all, the healthcare providers can only do so much.
Right.
While they are, in most places, among the largest employers and most significant organizations, they can be making sure that they are assessing the issues, that they are investing their community benefit dollars required by federal law to invest in the things that produce health. But for the most part, the healthcare providers need partnership with mayors, with business groups, with the nonprofit organizations, with philanthropy. So what we see in the communities that are working are three things. One is they are taking a multi-sector approach, mm-hmm. recognizing that it will take business, government, nonprofit, everyone working together to address these complex issues, particularly if you understand that it's housing and income and education and jobs and all those things that are actually upstream. Secondly, that we need to create a much greater system of accountability to measure what matters and not only do good things, but to ensure that there's a civic commitment across those sectors to address these issues over time. And that essentially is a functioning of our democracy, of essentially building the community and political will to make the long-term investment. Listen, these increasing rates of deaths of despair and diseases of despair and the turnaround of lifespan, that didn't happen overnight.
Yep.
Those are generational investments that have landed us where we are. So the civic leadership we're seeing in, again, red and blue communities, red and blue states across the country, they're taking a comprehensive approach to what creates health. They're building partnerships, they're taking accountability, and they're making a long-term view, just like we do with our kids.
Mm-hmm.
You know, raising a family is 20, 25 years at least, minimum.
At least, right.
You don't just say, well, I read to them in fourth grade, you know, I did it for 2 or 3 years, what's the deal? No, we take a generational approach. And the communities that are taking a generational approach to improving health are the ones where we see the greatest outcomes, not just 2 and 3 year quick projects that come and go.
Mm-hmm. And they also really rely on their anchor institutions, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And you put your finger on a real opportunity right now, particularly for hospital systems, for universities, for city governments, and businesses that really feel rooted in their communities. These organizations can hire local and build workforce pipelines, partnering with community colleges and high schools and universities to hire more from the community and make sure that we're growing a pipeline of communities, particularly from a pipeline for jobs, particularly from disadvantaged communities where kids see the opportunity. Secondly, these big anchor institutions can buy more local. There's a lot of pressure to source nationally and globally to get the best price. But when you buy from local companies that are owned locally, you essentially spin that local economic flywheel, what a chamber of commerce would call multipliers. When you buy from large national firms, profits leave town. That doesn't mean we should stop trading with every large company we know in the country, but we need to recognize that when you hire local, when you buy local, when you invest local, that wealth recirculates locally rather than being pumped out to profit centers and capital centers like our big cities in the U.S. and around the country. So that's what anchor institutions can really be doing. And these anchor institutions can also not only use their own purchasing power, hiring power, and investment portfolios differently, but they can also help drive the civic conversation that says, this is what creates health. We need long-term commitments and be part of anchor strategies to create jobs. I mean, one real specific example of that is around treating people with diabetes or hypertension who we know need to eat healthier. Well, many of these individuals are also food insecure. So there is a growing movement for growing local, healthy, fresh food that grows green local jobs in the community that can essentially fulfill food prescriptions for people who are needing healthier food to manage their health care. So in these at-risk arrangements, you start to see places where we need people that need access to healthy, affordable, fresh food, and there are business opportunities for local companies to be growing that food, fixing and preparing that food, serving that food. We start to see the connection between the things that improve health in the first place and the driving of the local economy. That is a place where the sort of the localism movement in the United States meets what produces health in the first place. Those are very virtuous, positive strategies that we see growing in communities across the country.
They sure are. Let me get you out on this, Tyler. Boy, there is so much to do, and you've stated it beautifully, and the urgency of all this cannot be overstated, but the organization has limited resources and limited bandwidth to take on all these challenges. So what are your priorities and what critical areas will Wellbeing Trust focus on in the next couple years in order to optimize your impact?
As the largest national foundation focusing on mental health in the country and being new, we really five areas are most important for us. One is clinical transformation. Our resources came out of the healthcare sector. So first, we're focused on making sure that a whole person, spirit, mind, body approach is in place in primary care settings, in the emergency department, and acute care. So we're really leaning back into the healthcare sector that we came from to make sure that care addresses the whole person. Secondly, as we've been talking about much of this call, we're partnering with community organizations across the country to ensure that the conditions that give rise to intergenerational well-being, again, income, education, transportation, housing, that communities are making commitments. Thirdly, we have a major commitment to policy and advocacy. We are blessed to live in a democracy that is capable of looking at what works. And because we're seeing such a red-blue transpartisan work on the ground around that, we're committed to building the community and political will to make the investments in what creates health. That's a big focus for us. And then in opening the conversations, in Denver, the great questions you've asked and what you're doing in the dialogues that you're creating is a big part of what we care about, which is opening the conversation in the country. And then we want to measure what matters so that we are assuring that we're, one, focusing on the places where there's the greatest need and making sure that what we're doing is adding up to impact. So that's really what our agenda is. But we can't do that alone. Everything we do, we need to do through partnership. We have a mantra, do what we do best, partner for the rest. And that recognizes that to create essentially a social movement about what creates well-being is a distributed job. We can only do so much. So our job is to be able to help individuals ask questions, what can I do around my own well-being? How can I support the well-being of my family and friends at work and school, et cetera? And really, take a distributed approach to what creates health and recognize that not only can we turn to one another to meet much of what ails us, but that we can engage in our democracy, in our communities, and in our states, in a national environment, and particularly when it feels like toxic partisanship is pulling us apart as a nation. These issues can bring us together and remind us that whatever may divide us, that which connects us is greater still.
Well, Tyler Norris, the Chief Executive Officer of Wellbeing Trust, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. What is your website and what information will visitors find on it?
Well, thank you. Go to www.wellbeingtrust.org, wellbeingtrust.org, to learn more about not only what Wellbeing Trust and our partners are doing, but what you can do in your own household or place of work or worship or school to help drive the change. We welcome your partnership, and thanks for this conversation tonight.
Well, and thank you, Tyler. It was a real pleasure to have you on the program.
All best.
I'll be back with more of the Business of Giving right after this.
Before you give to charity, go to CharityNavigator.org. Charity Navigator provides free ratings of thousands of America's largest charities, helping you get the most out of your charitable dollar. CharityNavigator.org, your guide to intelligent giving.
Johnny, that's better than most. That is better than most. Better than most!
Better Than Most is a regular feature of the Business of Giving, examining the best places to work among social businesses and nonprofit organizations.
And this evening, we will be heading down to Washington, D.C., and the headquarters of Truth Initiative. They are America's largest nonprofit public health organization dedicated to making tobacco use a thing of the past. We'll begin with their president and CEO, Robin Cavall, and she'll be followed by other members of the Truth Initiative team.
I always feel that if you don't make an attempt to really create and direct the culture of an organization, it gets created around you. It happens whether you like it or not. It's what is in the sort of ether of, you know, the office every single day. And you can let it happen to you, or you can make sure that it's someplace and that the people that are here are helping to build it consciously. So that's part of where my feelings come from. The other thing that I think is really important for us, and I think especially important in nonprofits, I mean, we do deal with serious issues. We talk about tobacco all the time. We know the devastating, deadly effects of tobacco. We are saving lives in that serious business. But I also think we do a really good job and make a concerted effort of also understanding that the role of fun and play in being a creative organization and looking for ways to inspire ourselves through the use of things that are fun and playful.
One of the ways that we try and make sure that the team members who we bring on board are comfortable in a team science environment is really to talk about how they've contributed in the past, how important authorship policy is to them, and how comfortable they are in sharing information and ideas rather than being more individually and self-focused. So I think that collaboration is really, really important in developing a team effort, but particularly around team science.
I also have worked in the nonprofit world for 20 plus years, and the way that this organization takes care of their employees is pretty amazing. We recognize everybody for their great work, but I think most importantly, we listen to people. And this is really important for the work that I do because we are out there in the communities talking to young people every day, and we listen to what they have to say and their stories and why they care about tobacco. And so that's incredibly important to me.
I think culture starts from the top down. I think culture is about transparency, honesty, truth is what we stand for, and that's what we exemplify in every single employee here. I think what brings me to work every single day are the people and the energy and the passion and the debate. And it's not an easy place to work. And I love that. I love that challenge. And every day we ask our team, like, how are you fighting big tobacco today? And everybody's got a different answer. And once a week we get together and we have what we call quote fights, so life quotes, and each of us sort of competes on who won that life quote for that week so that we can have that for the mantra for the next week. And I wouldn't change a thing about this place.
One of the greatest things I believe that helped us is the office space. People were going crazy about like moving to an open environment. What I loved is that we all came. We got used to it. People love it now. One of the greatest comments I had was someone who's at a VP level who was in an office, who was now in an open space. And I go and check, and I'm like, oh, well, how's it going? How do you like the space? And she says, this is the best space I've ever had in my career. I'm like, wow, you're not in the office anymore. She's like, I was so afraid of that. But what I find is that I can talk to people without setting up a meeting and, you know, wasting all that time. I see people going down the hall. I grab them.
I think for me, what I love about this place, and having been here now 15 years, when I walked in the door, the youth smoking rate in the United States was about 22-23%. Now it's 5.4%. That is millions of years of life that's saved from disease, from death, from misery. I think when people think about tobacco, they think about the death rate. We see real numbers, and I think a lot of times people in social cause organizations are fighting the good fight, but they don't get to see as dramatic results as we do. And there's really a primary reason that we do it. It's because we're completely focused on the metrics. We know where we're going. We hold ourselves accountable. And we've gotten there. And I could not be more proud of the work we've done.
One really important thing in my head is that we have a strategy. I've worked at several nonprofits, and they have had what I call shiny object syndrome. And it's like something pops up on the scene, we got to work on that. Another thing pops up on the scene, we got to work on that. And this organization is really strategy focused. We have a strategic plan. Everyone follows it. And we all know where we're going and what we should be working on to achieve the mission.
I remember being in school and seeing the truth ads and being like, I need to work there. And I came and I worked here for 4 years, and I left and worked at many other places, but there was something about truth that always drew me back. And I think it really is the culture. I think that a lot of the senior staff have been here for the entire time, and they're really caring, and you know that they care about your career development. You know that they want to give you the opportunity to succeed. And it's just, it's been a great opportunity, and I'm so happy that I came back.
We are making a difference, and the people at Truth are amazing. We constantly do surveys, and you didn't need a survey to know this, but 90% of the people love working with each other, and that is so evident when you walk through the doors. And again, so I feel really lucky to be doing this job and to know that I personally am making a difference with my colleagues at Truth Initiative.
To me, culture is somewhat synonymous, actually, with the name that we made up for this relatively new expertise center. We are known as Innovations, and I think our work here particularly and throughout the foundation is innovative. It's creative, it's crafty, it's nimble, it's flexible, and I think that really permeates through all the different aspects of our work. We've had the good fortune to be able to acknowledge talent and to promote people by creating new titles. Being innovative with hiring and with performance management to recognize why people come to Truth Initiative, what they want to get out of this experience, and to help them grow and to nurture both early career, mid-career, and everybody throughout their career life cycle.
Several years later, we found ourselves in a litigation with one of the large tobacco manufacturers, and we spent 5 years fighting. And as one who was deposed, and really spent a lot of time and effort as part of this litigation. I can tell you that the fearlessness of the people who sit in this organization is a key characteristic. And I think because we were born of a litigation and have suffered through a litigation, there comes a tenacity and flexibility, I think, that is really at the ethos of the culture here. And I think part of that gets reflected in, I'll call it interdisciplinary, but we come to this work each from our own areas of expertise. And I think that that is both the challenge and the brilliance of the organization that helps build the culture.
One of the processes that we just did today, which was funny, was we were just introducing new hires. And you could have just gone with their resume or their background or their education. But instead, we started talking about what made them unique. What were their passions? What kind of food do they like? Who are they as people? And I started to think about our team and how we hire for those people that are opposite of ourselves so that we can really have rich debate and good thought leadership. There are people on my team who went to school for equestrian arts. There are people on my team who learned how to twerk. It can straddle all kinds of different things.
Just the process. We involve people from different departments. It's not, oh, someone in marketing, only marketing people will interview them. We said, no, they're going to be working with the research team, so we definitely have to have someone from research, ask them questions and fill them out. And so I think the process, the onboarding, I mean, we've always have people tell us they've never been onboarded, they've never had this many trainings and, been able to get a feel of the organization, talk to different people, learn things before just kind of being thrown in.
For every opening, we make sure we canvass the entirety of people we promoted in minority publications and minority job groups and professional societies. We make sure we advertise everywhere. We make sure we interview a broad diversity of candidates. And it's reflected in who we hire.
I've been asked recently to speak at some cybersecurity conferences. And I speak from a nonprofit perspective. And it's a little different because most of the people I'm up against are the DOD or big business or corporations and other type of companies. But when I go out and I mention that I'm from the Truth Initiative, I see kind of an awe across the audience that says, my daughter watches your campaigns. My son or somebody in their families actually benefited from the fact the programs that we had. So it's a good sense of pride to be able to be part of an organization like that that's actually influenced and gives us feedback that we're doing something positive and people are actually listening to move forward.
I'll just say one thing about feedback. I have a very blunt style, and I really appreciate when people don't beat around the bush. And I feel like we're a family here, and it really feels like we can speak honestly to each other, for better or for worse. But people are really direct, which I think helps with our communications and our daily work.
And our motto is speak, seek, and share the truth. And it is also an atmosphere where we can speak freely. And not just about what's wrong or if you have a problem or if you need to just be direct with someone, but if you have an idea. You know, ideas can come from anywhere in the organization and be brought to bear. And I think that's so important because that prevents the silo effect. And I don't think we have silos because we have one common enemy, and that's big tobacco. Mm. And while we are very competitive, we're not competing with each other to see whose department delivered the best profits or the best numbers. We're competing against big tobacco. We are the David to that Goliath, and we're kicking its butt. So, pun intended.
Great.
There's you're leaving the ivory tower and heading into a non-academic position. How is that? And the thing that was my go-to response, and it was probably within just the first couple of months of being here, was it's really easy to get good work done. It's really easy to set a goal, to map out a path to get to that goal, because people do their jobs. They do them well.
I want to thank all those who participated in this segment. Trisha Kenny, Donna Vallone, Amy Taylor, Nicole Doyler, Anna Spriggs, Dave Dobbins, Derek Butts, Nicole Dufer, Amanda Graham, and Starla Stiles. If you would like to hear this again, read the transcript, or see pictures of the participants in the Truth Initiative offices, all you need to do is go visit denver-frederick.com. And we'll have a link there to my full interview with Robin Cavall, the president and CEO of Truth Initiative.
Top companies have now begun to discover a reliable source for skilled new talent, and they're finding great success with employees who are productive, engaged, and innovative. Explore the country's largest untapped talent pool, 24 million Americans with disabilities. The National Organization on Disability is the leading partner for companies looking to accelerate their disability employment efforts, attract, hire, and retain. Learn more at NOD.org.
There are as many people in this country addicted to alcohol and drugs as there are who have diabetes. More than 20 million, a staggering number, and there are another 20 million who are in recovery. A big reason for that is the opioid crisis, which has tripled in just the last 15 years. Finding innovative ways that philanthropic organizations can address this issue has never been more important. And there's a group in New Hampshire that is doing just that. Reporting the story for the Chronicle Philanthropy has been Megan O'Neill, who's with us now. Good evening, Megan.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, tell us about the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation.
So, the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation is unique in that it's one of the rare large philanthropies in the United States that has a charitable fund dedicated to addressing the issues of substance abuse and addiction. They had a donor in the late 1990s, a chicken farmer actually, who donated his entire estate. It ended up totaling about $43.5 million to tackle this issue. And they've done it in a really innovative way. They didn't decide that they were just going to sort of fund recovery centers or pay for beds and treatment programs. What they decided to do is that they were going to spur or trigger more public spending on the issue. So in the late 1990s, the state of New Hampshire, which has historically very high rates of substance abuse, was spending a whopping sum of $25,000 a year in state money to address addiction there. Now, in recent years, they're spending many tens of millions of dollars, and that's a result, actually, a lot of the advocacy work this charitable foundation has done there.
You know, you just said a moment ago that it's a big problem in New Hampshire. How big is the addiction problem up there?
So the 2017 statistics are still forthcoming, but in 2016, New Hampshire had the second highest per capita death rate for opioid-related deaths in the country. And there's sort of complicated reasons for that. One of them is being that the state is sort of in a key commercial corridor for drug trafficking between Boston, New York, and the Canadian border. But the state does also have a long history of alcohol abuse. It has some of the highest rates of alcohol consumption in the country. So it's a lot of complex socioeconomic factors at play there, and probably a good dose of genetics as well.
Well, being dedicated to advocacy and getting the public sector involved, one of the first things the foundation did was endow a new organization called New Futures. Tell us about them.
So New Futures has been sort of a key function of the foundation's work in trying to tackle the issue of addiction in New Hampshire. And one of their sort of early big victories was to get the state legislature to pass a bill that earmarked a certain percentage of alcohol revenue sales there to go into, you know, substance abuse treatment and public health initiatives. And that has in turn unleashed what has subsequently become about $50 million in spending on the issue in the state.
You know, I would imagine they probably took a lot of heat with this approach. Everybody's saying, hey, we need more beds, we need more counselors, but they held fast, didn't they?
That's right. They did take some criticism when they decided to go the route of advocacy rather than paying, you know, directly for services. Some people said, you know what, we need more counselors, we need more nurses, we need more doctors who are specializing in this stuff. And the foundation said, you know, we're not going to be able to sort of spend our way or grant our way out of this problem. We need the public sector and we need public dollars to really turn the tide here. And I think that was pretty forward thinking. I think that there's probably going to be proof to their wisdom there.
Yeah, I would imagine so. In addition to the alcohol fund, are there any other key pieces of legislation that they've been instrumental in seeing that they get passed?
There have. New Hampshire passed the Medicaid expansion, which has been critical in expanding coverage for substance use disorders in the state. They've done some sort of innovative or controversial things, including passing a law that allows for the creation of sites for clean needle exchange.
Hmm.
You know, not everybody thinks that there should be a place where people who are using can go and exchange paraphernalia, but there's, you know, research that shows that can cut down on things like, you know, diseases diseases that are transmitted by, you know, dirty or shared needles. So this advocacy group, New Futures, which the foundation was able to stand up, has been key or instrumental in numerous pieces of legislation of that nature.
Yeah, and they've also been pretty savvy in getting private dollars and then having the public dollars follow that either on a match basis or a near match basis.
That's right. They're really plugged into sort of all the public policy work that's happening there. So, for example, you know, if they have a private donor come to the foundation with $1 million or $2 million to tackle a specific piece of addiction care, they can take that money as sort of bait, right? They can go to the state and say, you know, we have this private donor who's going to give $1 million to address addiction amongst, you know, new moms, for example. And they can ask the state to kick in their own, you know, matching dollars and really move additional funds that way.
Yeah. And finally, I mean, they've been sort of a model for cross-sector collaboration. I guess the way they've gotten everybody on the table, when something comes up, all the players and the key players are there and know each other and have a relationship and trust each other.
That's right. There's a really interesting executive at the foundation, a guy named Tim Rourke, and he's spent the last decade or so really sort of working the halls of the state legislature and the various state agencies there, and has built up tremendous rapport such that, you know, he can go into the Department of Health and other places and get everyone sort of rowing in the same direction. A couple of people, when I went up there to write the story or report the story, said that the foundation is really critical because they're seen as a neutral partner, right? They're there to serve the public and maybe not necessarily to defend a budget line item or something like that. So they said having this sort of neutral philanthropy or this neutral nonprofit leader in this role has been absolutely crucial.
Yeah, well, a very interesting model how a foundation with relatively modest means has really become such a key player in a state and has had an enormous impact. Thanks so much for this report, Megan.
Thanks for having me.
And that is this week's show. Next week, my guest will be Leslie Crutchfield, the executive director of the Global Social Enterprise Institute at Georgetown University and the author of the just-released book, How Change Happens, Why Some Social Movements Succeed While Others Don't. I am looking forward to that. Thanks for listening. Have a great week, and I hope you'll return next Sunday evening for The Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of The Business of Giving.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.